Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe, delivering custom solutions for businesses with complex internet-facing infrastructures. DataPipe manages the entire infrastructure, including data center operations, servers, applications, storage, monitoring, and security. DataPipe.com.
Have you ever wondered why most emails are written in Arial, or why most of the things you write in Microsoft's Word are in Times New Roman, unless you choose to change the font? Or why, when a new font is used in a company logo or on a magazine cover, it seems to change everything? On today's edition of Please Explain, we are looking at typefaces and typography and why they're important to communication and design. And joining us are Jonathan Heffler, a designer of typefaces and president of the Type Foundry Heffler and Frere Jones. I'm also pleased to welcome back to our show Stephen Heller, co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author program at the School of Visual Arts and author of the Visuals column for the New York Times Book Review. Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jonathan, first, let's clarify. Are the words typefaces and type fonts interchangeable?
Pretty much. I mean, a typeface in theory is the concept of a design, and a font is the implementation of that design. But these days, we tend to use all the words typeface and font interchangeably.
When, Stephen, did typefaces first begin to be standardized? How far back does that go?
Well, it goes back to the 18th century, but the standardization of type, the nomenclature of type, is more the late 19th century.
Was calligraphy was the norm until we had printing. Was Gutenberg the first type designer?
Well, it depends how you answer the question, I suppose, but Gutenberg is best known for inventing castable, movable type, but what he was doing is enshrining the forms of calligraphy in printing type. So I guess the short answer is yes.
He was designing a typeface,
or
using one anyway, where all the letters were always the same.
Right.
And that's an important part of this, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, a typeface is a system where every time you see the same letter, it's identical, as opposed to lettering or calligraphy, where it can be unique each time.
And a bunch of classic faces were developed over the years. There are a whole bunch from the Renaissance on. Weren't they just the norm for a long time? When did people become interested in developing modern fonts?
Well, there was also, before modern fonts, there was an interim period. And you could call it the display font period. These were times in the 1800s and the 1900s primarily, when commerce began and type was used as advertising display. And so many of the foundries started doing things that would set their words apart from other words.
And from the beginning, did people realize that a typeface could somehow distinguish yourself and actually tell people something about your intentions and who you are?
I think that's arguable. I mean, as Steve was saying, for the first 3 centuries of typography, there was this sort of business-as-usual fonts are made for books, and there were variations, italic typefaces for setting verse, Roman typefaces for setting secular works, black letter for liturgical things. But it really wasn't until the 1800s that there was this notion of this kind of font is meant for a lottery ticket or a handbill or a poster or a circus.
And this one says quality, and this one says cheap, or something like that.
And it indicates what business, what a merchant was involved in. And it came off of signs, and it came off of labels on bales of hay and barrels and the like. So type started having a different source than the original humanist typefaces that were produced.
For a long time, there were the classic faces like Bodoni, or in early America, Caslon, and then we started seeing new versions of Bodoni, new versions of Caslon, because the old ones weren't working, or
right.
But people liked the way they looked?
Yeah, I think there are two parts to that. I mean, one is that the old technologies vanished. The idea of setting type by hand as pieces of metal simply disappeared, and phototype came about, and then digital type, and there was the need to recreate these things. And the other is the artistic angle, that as a type designer, you might see something in the original source you want to interpret in some way. So there are now hundreds of Bodonis and Caslons.
Are all of the old ones serif faces? First of all, maybe we should talk about what is serif and what is sans serif.
Serif is the face with the little feet, and sans serif is without the feet.
And the general sense is, conventional wisdom, is that it's easier to read serif faces. Books are usually set serif type.
That's the general conception, yes.
Do you agree?
Well, I think it's individual, and I think it's also the way something is set. Type is not a monolithic form. It's something that is used differently by different designers or different compositors. So it really depends on how much space there is or leading between lines. I feel there are a number of issues that determine what's legible, what's readable.
Well, I guess according to the computer people, Arial and Times Roman are the most readable. Is that because they are, or simply because they're the ones that they got for free, or is there something else going on there?
Well, I think a lot of it is custom. I mean, the notion that serif faces are easier to read is because we've all grown up seeing serif typefaces in newspapers and magazines and books. Sans serif faces like Helvetica are the ones that come with the computer, and now 15 years into the web, we're all accustomed to seeing everything on our screens look like this. So this is sort of becoming the vernacular of online. Whether it's clear or not, I guess, is arguable, but it's definitely the custom.
And it also depends on the culture. The Germanic faces were all black letter for decades, for centuries. The text faces were those horrible fracture typefaces, the spiky things that you and I couldn't read, but a good German could read.
Mm-hmm. But now a German newspaper would look more like an American newspaper or a French newspaper?
Sure, although there are nationalistic tendencies in type, depending on where they buy their type, who designs the typeface. For the longest time, you could always tell something that came out of England because it used Gill or it used some other typeface that was consistent.
Instead of Helvetica, they used Folio, which looks like
good call.
Helvetica, but
right.
But it's not the same.
Well, an Accidents Grotesque preceded Helvetica, and that was a face that was used throughout Europe at one time.
Jonathan, how many fonts has your company, Heffler and Fred Jones, designed?
I always lose count. I think it's about 1,000 at this point, of which about a little more than half are available for sale.
And why would you be designing a new font? Is it because you've thought of a distinctively new way to draw certain letters, or has a client come to you and said, I want something that works with my, that's going to make my jewelry store look different or my magazine look different?
Right. It's a little of both. I mean, half of the challenges that we face are aesthetic. Find a way to do a typeface that, well, we're releasing a font next week, and I'm trying to do a typeface that feels more like Steve McQueen than Steven Seagal, and these very sort of ineffable qualities trying to imbue the design with, and those are always kind of hard to hunt down. But the other are things that are purely mechanical. Doing a typeface that works for the stock listings of a newspaper has very mechanical constraints that are measurable, and as presses change and paper changes, and now, of course, the medium of the web is changing everything, fonts need to be constructed in different ways to make them actually work. So it's this game that's sort of half mechanical, half visual.
In some cases, aren't fonts designed just to solve a problem? I remember a magazine called Avant Garde.
Oh, yeah.
And the only letters that were designed were the letters that spelt out the name of the magazine, Avant Garde, and then people liked the face so much then.
Well, that was a face that had an extreme number of ligatures, which are intersecting letters. And it was a typeface designed by a man named Herb Lubalin, designed first as a logo, as you say, and then because it was modern, because it was contemporary, people bought into it as a typeface and used it forever ad nauseum.
So then Herb Lubalin had to come up with numbers and all sorts of other letters and an italic version and all the rest. He had only designed AVANTGARDE.
That's right. And the ligature was, you can't even count that because it was unique. It was like a logo. Also, he once said that it should never have been made into a typeface.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was hard to read, actually. We're talking about typefaces and typography on today's Please Explain with Stephen Heller, co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author Program at the School of Visual Arts and author of the Visuals column in the New York Times Book Review, and Jonathan Heffler, a typeface designer and president of the Type Foundry, Heffler and Frere Jones. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a little while later, we will be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. A listener has already written in, Tony in San Jose, California, asks, how many Japanese and Chinese fonts are there? Does the same sort of thing happen in other kinds of letter systems?
Absolutely. I mean, it's actually kind of an interesting time for non-Latin typography right now in that the technology is now in place to allow people to make these typefaces. People who use Macintoshes and PCs have, for most of the history of the computer, been bound to the Latin alphabet, and it's now much simpler to design a typeface for Arabic with these very exotic features for joining calligraphic strokes and things. Japanese and Chinese as well have there are new opportunities to make them, and there's just an explosion of new work.
A listener from Barcelona, Yvette, asks, can you comment on the fairly new Eco font from the Netherlands with the little holes written within the lettering that'll save as much as 20% on ink? Do you know about that, Stephen?
I don't know about that one specifically, but there have been a variety of typefaces, Jonathan may know more than I, that are meant to be biodegradable, so to speak. What I would say is that there are many type designers who look at their type not so much purely in a functional way, but in an artistic way. And they see this as a medium. Of course it has functionality. Of course it's going to convey message. But they look at type as something that has more symbolic and metaphoric power.
Well, how much can we learn about what a person or a company thinks about itself by the typeface that it chooses? There was a time, there's a whole film about Helvetica. And in it, the claim is that everybody who wants to look really institutional will use Helvetica in its logo. So we have everything from Con Ed to the sanitation department designing their logos in Helvetica. Other people think that it's kind of boring.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the best things you can do is track what happens when any organization changes its typeface. The number of people who are up in arms because they can't spot the brand anymore, the number who feel disenfranchised, the number who look at the brand for the first time.
And that we've seen that with IKEA, which just recently changed the typeface in its catalog from Futura to Verdana, which is a typeface that I only thought was designed for my computer. And people really got upset because they had so associated IKEA with Futura.
People sometimes don't have lives. You know, the fact of the matter is Futura is not a very good text face. So they made a change that was substantive. But you do get used to things, and you build your habits around them.
Well, you've written about the use of typography and symbols in dictatorships, for example, the way the Nazis used them. Did they choose certain types of typefaces that would have conveyed the kind of power that they wanted to convey?
Well, they chose a typeface that went back in their history, which was Fraktur or Black Letter. They called it the Volk type. They called other typefaces Judenlettern. So they imbued an ideological presence into their typefaces. But, you know, left on their own, without the context, they're just type. And either they're easy to read or they're hard to read.
But if I am looking for a typeface to convey something about my company, I am in a fashion business, I'm not going to use the same kind of typeface that somebody who's in a heavy machinery business would use, would I?
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, a lot of typefaces are designed to be as versatile as possible. And the idea should be that there isn't merely one reading of the typeface. It allows a designer to use this as a raw material and express something different. But it definitely requires sensitivity.
Well, how do you go about designing a typeface? I'm assuming today you don't do it by hand. Everything is done on a computer.
Yeah. I mean, we use computers for everything, but we're still drawing each character individually, starting with a capital H, and then however
H is the first one you do?
Yeah.
Why?
It's symmetrical. It's square. It has flat sides, and it gives you a general sense of the proportion of the design, and it has the stems, which are the vertical strokes.
So once you've determined what your H is going to look like, does the A automatically fall into line? Does the E automatically fall into line?
In theory, yes. In practice, never. Next comes the O because it's round, the lowercase, a lowercase N because it's square, O because it's round, a lowercase H that has an ascending stroke, a P that has a descending stroke. There's a kind of a set of steps you go through, and then at a certain point, the idea is that
then you have to figure out how the R is going to look.
Well, right. And then, of course, it's time for the section mark and the yen and the schwa and all of this other stuff. And there's definitely a kind of arms race in type. Fonts are 10 times bigger than they were 10 years ago.
And then there are faces that kind of tell us the intention. For example, Courier, which we have on our computers, which looks like typewriter type. I always wondered why the typewriter type even looked like that in the first place.
Yeah. It's Tobias Furr-Jones, my partner, has some interesting theories about that. One thing he's pointed out is that those very big beefy serifs that a typewriter typeface has allow the weight of a hammer to be distributed evenly as it strikes the ribbon onto a page. Of course, 130 years later, that's not really relevant anymore. But as we were saying earlier about custom, we've been accustomed to looking at correspondence looking like this.
Right. Also, stylistically, Courier and Elite tended to look a little bit like the Victorian display typefaces with heavy serifs. So there may have been a stylistic motivation.
Is there a reason that we seem to see the same typefaces in books all the time?
Well, I guess
Garamond and
yeah, it's habit for one, but also designers are very passionate about their typefaces. There are some that will only use two typefaces or one typeface. They look at them, they caress them, they hold them. I mean, there's a very erotic sensibility that comes along with typefaces, going back to when they were hot metal.
Do we get subliminal? I keep on circling around to this, but do we get subliminal messages from the way type is used?
Oh, I think definitely.
Absolutely.
We get subliminal messages.
A clever designer will use a typeface in a way to get across something that we may not even understand, except on a subconscious level.
I think so, and I also think there are ways of using type so that you avoid people reading them. For a reason. You know, when you get into the fine print of something, you could make it readable, very readable, but, the pharmacy companies don't want to make it readable. So there are all sorts of ways of using type manipulatively.
It's been my experience that magazines that are aimed at older people have a lot clearer type than magazines aimed at younger people. It's almost as though the younger ones are purposely trying to make the typography as hard to read as possible, maybe to scare away the wrong demographic.
Well,
you're smiling.
I think there was a time, maybe 15 years ago, when certain younger designers were creating typography that was codified. It was meant to be a code. So like the psychedelic posters in mm-hmm. the 60s, it was meant to be a code. It wasn't meant for the 50-year-old or the 40-year-old. But certainly as the baby boomers get older, the type gets heavier, the type gets larger, the leading gets wider, and the colors move from pink and gray to black.
Our phone number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. WNYC. My guest on today's Please Explain in talking about typefaces and typography are Stephen Heller, co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author program at the School of Visual Arts, author of the Visuals column for the New York Times Book Review, and Jonathan Heffler, a typeface designer and also president of the Type Foundry Heffler and Frere Jones. Again, 212-433-9692. You can also leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be back with your calls and your questions on Please Explain right after this. We are back with Jonathan Heffler, who is a typeface designer, and Stephen Heller, who is a designer and, in fact, co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author program at the School of Visual Arts. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. 9692. We also are getting all sorts of messages from listeners around the world. One, before we get to the calls, this one is always confounded me as well. A listener wants to know about wingdings. Why should someone create a font that looks like that? Does anybody use those things?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, decoration is something that everybody wants to use, and it's only the purists that won't use them. But wingdings are a lot of fun. It allows freedom. Don't take type so seriously. You know, play around. Have fun on the page.
I mean, I'd also add that there's a whole kind of parallel universe of typography that isn't letters, it's symbols. We all know the symbols for men's room and women's room bathrooms and airplane and takeoff and landing and whatever. I don't know how many symbols the average American knows, but it's a big set of things. Even though the at symbol has joined a typeface as the shorthand for email, it's a relatively new thing. And I think we're going to see more imports into the alphabet as time goes on.
Another listener wants to know how many typefaces there are. Does anybody know?
I have no idea.
It seems to me an awful lot of them are very similar, aren't they? I mean, for example, we've been talking about Arial and Helvetica. They pretty much look the same to me. I'm sure that somebody with a really discerning eye can spot the difference. Should I assume that Arial was designed to avoid having to pay for the copyrights for Helvetica?
That sounds about right.
But there are many, many, many sans serif faces that looked like Futura when that was first designed in the 20s, but they were slightly different variations, not because they were trying to avoid copyright, but because the designer, for example, couldn't draw straight lines.
And how important is the name? For example, there was something like Futura called Airport. I always wondered why it was called Airport.
Naming is one of the hardest things in designing a typeface, actually. I mean, as there are more and more fonts, there are fewer and fewer names. And we try to choose names that are both evocative, obviously original, and contain some of the signature letters from the typeface.
Why not just call it Heffler Bold and Heffler Italic?
Well, there is a Heffler text, actually. And there's a designer, Frederick Gowdy, who did Gowdy text, Gowdy Old Style, Gowdy Sans, and 30 typefaces later, he's running out of Gowdy's.
Uh-huh.
I did a typeface once when I was 18, and I only liked three of the letters, so I called it Claus Bubula Bold because it had a K, an L, and a B.
Did you start with the H? The way
no,
you
I started with the L because it was easiest.
Let's take some calls. Ron from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, this is Russ.
I was told Ron, but okay, Russ, hi,
yeah,
how are you?
How you doing? Pretty good, pretty good. Hey, the reason I was calling was about the Lucida type font, the one that's used in the phone book, and I just find it interesting that Lucida, I think, was designed by AT&T or for AT&T.
Yeah, I think you're thinking of Bell Centennial that Matthew Carter designed. That's the one used in the phone books. And that's a pretty interesting typeface. It was one of the first things designed to be used on newsprint. It does interesting things in the design, like it changes the proportions of letters in dramatic ways from one style to the next, solely with the format of the phone book in mind.
Yeah, but I just find Lucida extremely readable.
Yeah, no, that's a nice typeface as well.
At almost any font size.
And it doesn't use that much ink, so it doesn't bleed on that very cheap paper that the phone book uses.
That's a consideration? If somebody comes to you and asks you, Jonathan, to design a face, do you say, well, where is this going to be used? What kind of paper is it going to be printed on? What
Absolutely.
Kind of color are you going to be using?
We did a typeface family years ago called Mercury that's designed to work on newsprint in different settings, and we discovered things like a press in Miami that runs humid and a press in Tucson that is dry. The same typeface looks different. So there's a whole range of four typefaces used for different markets. So if they're printing in Denver or in Louisiana was one, different things happen on press, and the font can compensate for it.
And they wanted it to look exactly the same no matter where they printed it? I'd imagine the New York Times has to think about that when it runs its national edition in different parts of the country.
It has to think about that. It has to think about the fact that the paper got smaller, mm-hmm. Narrower. So there are all sorts of considerations. How do we get the same number of words on a page when we're losing physical space?
Well, some designers just make the type size smaller. Then you get down to what I used to call mice type.
Right. It's cheating.
Our next caller is Amy from Manhattan. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. I used to work for an electronics magazine that used a font in which the numbers were were shorter. You know, they only go to the what they call the X height, not the full height of capital letters. And they frequently needed to refer to ones and zeros, and it would look like is and us.
Yeah, those are called old style figures, and those were the custom in really all typefaces for typography's first four centuries. The numbers we all use today, or we typically use, are called lining figures that are all the same height as the capitals, and those are less than 200 years old. Actually, they're an innovation in typeface.
Does some of this have to do with the fact that type was a piece of metal on a wood block, and you had to get all of those wood blocks next to each other, tight next to each other, so that it didn't look like there were big spaces?
Yeah, I mean, context is an important thing in type design, and numbers that are designed to work with the lowercase have to have those projecting strokes that go up and down the way a lowercase h and a lowercase p do. That's where you wind up with old-style figures that vary. For things like ones and zeros, it's tough. We find also things like abbreviations like MRIs. If the MRI are in a small capital size and it's a lowercase s afterwards, it just looks like MRIS. It doesn't look like an abbreviation. So definitely the way in which we use language changes how typefaces are designed.
Well, also, remember in the old days when it was metal, a font weighed hundreds of pounds. Mm-hmm, it wasn't a disc. So you had to limit the amount of characters.
Well, you also have to think about how certain letters are going to work together. For example, if you design a typeface where you just have one straight line to represent a stroke, then a word like Lil, a name like Lil,
right,
becomes nothing. You can't even read it, right? L-I-L, unless you put a lot of space between each letter.
Yeah, this happens election season every year when there's a representative from Illinois on screen. You see capital
right.
I, lowercase L, lowercase L, and I think, who is this R the third who's running for Congress?
In fact, that was a problem for George Bush the first time he talked about the dictator of North Korea. He called him Kim Jong the third. We go now to Raymond from Manhattan. Hi, Raymond. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? This is a very interesting conversation. I wanted to find out why there's a limited number of fonts that are available on the Internet, both on the Mac platform and on the PC, whereas we have this plethora of fonts available out there that can be utilized. But with the digital age, they're only limited to about 9 or 10 fonts.
You're talking about things like web pages always coming up in the same typefaces?
Yeah,
there's been a shift in how typefaces work. I mean, when you're looking at a web page, it's rendering in the fonts that are on your computer, not the ones that the designer of the page intended to use. And there's a technological shift happening right now that's going to make that hopefully better in the coming year. But it's very strange to go from this universe of 100,000 typefaces down to just the same 9.
On the other hand, another listener wants to know, are the fonts available on our computers all free fonts? Because we see the same ones all the time.
For the most part, they're not. I mean, the fonts that come with your computer are ones that have been licensed from the original designer. So if you're using Lucida, it came from Lucida's designer through Apple or through Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Typefaces are not unlike music records. I mean, the creator of them hasn't just thrown them out into the marketplace. They require royalty.
Although I suspect a lot of people are still ripping them off the same way that they're ripping off the record companies.
Sure.
Pat from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm so happy to speak with you. This is so interesting. I came late to the conversation, and I was wondering if anybody put in a good word for Garamond and Bodoni, my two favorites, from when I used to design brochures and things and PR. But also, I had another question.
Wait, let's stop with those. Bodoni was a designer during the Renaissance, wasn't he?
Bodoni was a neoclassical designer, but there have been fonts called Bodoni in circulation pretty much ever since the 1780s.
But there has to be something that makes them a Bodoni rather than another typeface.
Sure, and it's also kind of in the eye of the beholder. It's like doing a neoclassical building, whether you've hit the mark or not is always arguable.
Bodoni has a museum in Parma. And designers will make pilgrimages there. That's the Mecca. If you can get in, it's very hard to get in because the guy who runs it is often on break.
Now, Bodoni is a kind of a thick and thin serif face, but it has very straight lines on its serifs.
Yeah, I mean, taxonomically.
Which distinguishes it from something else.
Right. I mean, the taxonomy is called a modern, and modern typefaces are those that have very thick stems, very thin hairlines, and no bracketing. And it was a revolutionary idea in typography in the 1780s, and I think it still kind of survived because of the integrity of the idea.
Yeah, very hard to print.
Pat, what was your question? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
I'm sorry. You know, I wondered, if my grandfather was a printer, and maybe this is why, but I have this attachment to feeling the typeface on the paper that I've never gotten over. When I used to work as a reporter, I knew I was doing okay when I can hear the keys hit the paper, and I wouldn't give up my pin dot printer for a long time either, because I like the strike of the letter on the paper. You know,
that's called the kiss.
I was wondering, you know, what... is that something that people don't care about anymore or do? Or, you know, there's an aesthetic sense there for me that I just don't get when I print out something, no matter how pretty the type is today, you know?
It's tough. I mean, there's a historian named Harry Carter who once said, type is something you can hold in the palm of your hand. And I think that really encapsulates the kind of kinesthetic experience of type that definitely is changing. I mean, a screen doesn't really have the same properties as a page. And, you know, hot off the press is kind of a vanishing notion.
A listener wants to know, is it better for a company or a brand to have its own typeface? Everyone recognizes the Coca-Cola font. Even
I'm sorry, I've lost you.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd moved on. But anyway, we recognize Coca-Cola font, even if it's not spelling out the brand. Is that what brands want when they commission an original typeface?
Sometimes. I mean, an important distinction is the logo versus the typeface. Coca-Cola is a great example. They have their logo that has been theirs and has evolved over the course of the last century, but it's still iconic for the brand. But they use one of our typefaces right now for this current season's campaigns, and it'll surely be another typeface in the future. A logo is a great kind of living, breathing thing that can evolve with the times and accompany any number of typefaces depending upon the setting, the context, and the mood.
But IBM, for example, has a very distinctive logo designed by Paul Rand, but he also impressed on the company to use a particular typeface, which was Bodoni, in fact. And it gave the printed materials of IBM a very classical look, which offset the notion of these are futuristic machines. So in a sense, it took the edge off the mechanistic part of IBM.
Now, Paul Rand is a name that, he was an influential type designer. Herman Zapp, Herb Lubalin. Are these the Bodonis of today?
I think they are. You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, Bodoni was – it's very difficult to look back and wonder whether Bodoni was attempting something new or not, whether his typefaces are simply the expression of his times and the way his hands worked and his eyes worked, or whether there was this intellectual conceit to make something new. Type designers today are always working to make something new or to revive something old. There's much more a kind of conscious spirit in what they do. So the craft has definitely changed. But, I mean, those are some of definitely the luminaries of this century.
A listener wants to know if there's a relationship between type and speed of reading. Can some typefaces allow us to read faster?
Well, I think there are typefaces that force us to read slower.
Yeah.
On purpose?
It could be on purpose. I think there are certainly textbooks where they've tested out the weight and the size of typefaces for that purpose. I always found it difficult, and it would slow me down when I had to read italic.
Right.
In fact, I would jump over anything in italic that was in a block, figuring it wasn't worth my while, and go to the next. But, you know, it's funny that in reading, we're often taught in school that the faster you get through something, the better it is. So speed is endemic to the whole reading process.
Actually, I'd say that an extension of that idea is things like ceremonial lettering. A wedding invitation printed in Spencerian script is created in that way to be kind of savored as opposed to read through quickly. I can imagine a newspaper set in Spencerian script being impossible to get through.
And we are disappointed if a wedding invitation comes in Helvetica, aren't we?
Yeah. That's, I mean...
On the other hand, the sanitation department would not use Spencerian for its logo.
They wouldn't dare.
They might try it under a new commissioner.
A listener wants to know, are there typefaces that are indicative of a time or a place? Are there trends in typography?
Always. Type really is a signpost for moments and for places. Art Deco, Art Nouveau, these are faces that come up all the time, and when you see them, you are sent back to that nostalgic period.
In fact, in the movies, that's one of the things that a designer will know if they want to give you a sense without ever telling you anything else. Yeah. They just simply do a newspaper with a certain typeface.
Right, and the anachronisms, every type designer I know, they just sit there waiting for them to appear.
I've yet to see the perfect movie. There's always just one thing done wrong that ruins it all typographically.
Well, for example, they set the type too close together. If it's right. In an earlier time, we've only been able to set type really close together in recent times because of phototype.
Right. And also there's other factors. I mean, you could be perfect on a page. I just saw this on Mad Men, but their paper was wrong.
Yeah.
Mad Men gets a lot of stuff wrong. I was in advertising at the time. We didn't all smoke and wear skinny ties. My guests have been Stephen Heller and Jonathan Heffler. Mr. Heller is co-chair of the MFA Designer and Author Program at the School of Visual Arts. Mr. Heffler is the designer and president of the Type Foundry, Heffler and Frere Jones, and we've been talking about typefaces and typography on Please Explain. Thank you both so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
On Monday's show, former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich explains Rod Blagojevich, and then editor Rafe Esquith on how parents and teachers can better equip their children to be successful in school. Also, Nicholson Baker discusses his latest book, The Anthologist. It's a novel about the importance of poetry in our everyday lives. Plus, Fox News contributor Geraldo Rivera discusses the ways he thinks Hispanics are revitalizing America. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephanie Bernhardt and Nicole Silbersack. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.